Yes, finally, with a bit of delay, we start. So as I mentioned before, we always start a quarter hour late, like you're perhaps known from university or have heard of that, because we know everybody's late all the time, so are we. So and now also video setup and the stream as well. So hello to everybody on the streams and hello to our nearly full house in here. There's kind of one space left here really on the front, but perhaps somebody will come in later. Today we do something we already did last year in December, lightning talks. Lightning talks are 10-minute talks about anything, about an idea, a project, a problem, whatever you want to come up. And I'm really happy that we have a long list of lightning talks for today. In total, I think 11, or did it even fill up? And we're now at 12. So yeah, it even filled out while we're here. So now we have in total 12 talks, each 10 minutes. So don't be scared, we don't make 120 minutes at all. At once, we will make a break after half of it. So after number six and number five, because of course we start counting with zero. And for everybody on the streams, the last ones you won't hear about because they won't be streamed, so don't wonder if suddenly the stream turns off. This is the advantage. If you come here, you see everything. So next time, be here. Okay, enough from myself. I'm really happy to have all of you here, and I'm really happy to start with the first talk, which is Crisis Response Makerspace, just human assemblies at 3433 C3 with Zeb. And yeah, come up here and let's start. Erfurt Kopie, ne? Genau. Aber das ist doch jetzt, hat das nicht auch schon PDF gemacht?
Ja.
Hier drauf ist die. Ah. Ah. Ja, gut.
Perfekt. Okay, dann halte ich auf Englisch. I don't understand German. So I speak in English? Okay, no problem.
Welche das ist, Vorbild? Ist egal.
Okay, hello everybody. I'm Sepp from Cardus. We are a humanitarian NGO that was founded 3 years ago in Berlin from a kind of lefty subculture. Meanwhile, we are working mainly in disaster and war zones, currently in Syria and Iraq. And I would like to tell you something about our crisis response makerspace here in Berlin. I heard just yesterday evening that I have the possibility to talk, so I didn't prepare at all, so I just speak whatever comes to my mind. When we were out in the fields, beginning in 2014 in Syria, and after that in Iraq and in the Mediterranean Sea as well, we did sea search and rescue last year, we witnessed that a lot of things changed over the past 10 to 15 years in humanitarian aid. The problems are getting much more dynamic. We have much more people who are fleeing. We have much more dynamic situations. We have asymmetric wars in the meanwhile. Asymmetric wars means we don't have two parties who are fighting each other, but we have one known party, like an army or something like that, and another group that is not okay with things like the Genfer Conventions or humanitarian law at all, like ISIS. Means humanitarians can't work in these areas. Normally, after humanitarian law, it should be that humanitarians are able to work in war zones on both sides and between, so that everybody, especially all civilians, can get medical care and stuff like that in these situations. In the meanwhile, this situation changed totally. We have it in Afghanistan, we have it in Iraq, we have it in Syria, that there are a lot of areas where we can't work anymore. We are pretty small NGO, so we had always to take a look for the possibility to improve our aid and our projects, and we try to find solutions to make our aid more professional, more flexible, more dynamic. And then we saw that on the humanitarian market, what a terrible word, you don't find solutions for that. No IT solutions, and no logistic solutions and no product solutions, because the humanitarian market is not big enough to give capitalists a good idea to earn some money. So there are really only a few companies who try to find solutions for the problems that occur. So we decided to take these things in our own hand, and we started to build a new kind of mobile hospital 1.5 years ago here in Berlin. We started on a Wagenplatz in winter, fucking cold, unbelievable fucking cold. And we ended up at the Holzmarkt in a pretty nice space, 200 square meters, where we could finish the mobile hospital. And we brought it in March 2017 to Northern Iraq, where we took part in the emergency response in Mosul. Everybody told us these days it's not possible to work directly behind the front line, like 1 kilometer, 1.5 kilometer behind the front line. We proved them wrong with our mobile and dynamic system. It was able to follow the front line and to be the first to treat the civilians that were fleeing from the IS. Out of this experience, we said, like, okay, we will go on with inventing solutions. And then the idea was, our ideas are not endless, so let's open the space, open the crowd to invite more people to take part. And so we are beginning at the moment to form out of this workshop where we built the mobile hospital a crisis response maker space. So a space open for new ideas. We have a lot of ideas like mine clearance solutions based on blimps, as I said, a new kind of mobile hospital with the learnings out of the version 1.0, the first civilian possibility for airdrop solutions. So we would like to form the first airborne emergency response unit to make things just sexier as they are already right now. And I think a month ago or something like that, the idea came up to go with this idea of the crisis response makerspace to the Congress this year as well, to the 34C3. And we teamed up with a lot of other organizations like Jugendrettet, Sea-Watch, HPI, which are the humanitarian pilots from Switzerland, Alarm Phone, Watch the Mage, but it's basically the same. There will be one person from MSF, and we will have an assembly on the 34C3, where we will show what we are doing, our ideas, our problems, where we are looking for solutions. We will have a lot of talks. I will have a big talk. Someone from Jugendrettet will have a big talk as well, and we will have several small talks in our assembly. So everybody is invited to join, and we are very lucky if there are people who would like to join our makerspace here in Berlin to help and to let it grow. I used only 5 minutes, hopefully, and I think I'm ready. If you're interested, you can take a look into the wiki. The assembly is called Just Humans, because the full name is No Borders, No Nations, Just Humans. But let's break down Just Humans. It's about like helping people either in the Mediterranean, in Iraq, in Syria, everywhere. So thanks for your attention. Have a nice evening.
Ja, ich glaube, wir haben jetzt 6 Leute gesagt, dass es F11 ist. Danke. Fürs nächste Mal werde ich das wissen. Okay, next one, Jacek. Okay, here we will switch laptop, if I'm right. No problem. So, let's see if that works. Ja, dauert noch einen Moment. Ha, sehr gut.
War der einzelne Display. Why? Okay.
Ah, yeah, you can have either the one or the other. He's having nothing on the screen. So, up to you.
Thank you. Hi. I'm Jacek. I do mostly hardware stuff instead of actually improving the world, so sorry for that. I'm going to talk about how to put pretty pictures on printed circuit boards. I don't know, who in this room has made their own printed circuit boards? Raise your hands. Oh, so actually a couple of people. That's nice. Yeah, so anyway, for everybody else, printed circuit board making is basically a multiple-step process. The first thing you always do is you write down a schematic. That looks like this. Second thing you do is you produce from this schematic like the actual board layout, which you can perfectly not see right on this display. Oh yeah, you can see it better now. So basically you have like a special kind of program that you use that like knows about your schematic and that you can then use to like place stuff like traces and stuff like components in your work area and connect everything up. It's basically kind of similar to a drawing tool, except it kind of makes sure you don't do anything really stupid like shorting out stuff so things start burning, or at least that's what it's supposed to be like. Then what you do is, after you have done that, you produce something called a Gerber file. This is basically a piece of text file, similar in format to what 3D printers use. It's basically a list of instructions, which you see here, like G36, start a polygon, and then like coordinates in like ASCII encoded numbers, which tell like where the corners of this polygon are. This text file, or like a collection of those, one for each layer of your printed circuit board, like for the tracks themselves, and then for the white printing on top, you send to your fab, your factory, and most of the time it's China, and then they will provide you with something that looks kind of like this. I will actually hand around a few of those. Maybe you can like have a brief look at them. Basically, it's a piece of like fiberglass with like copper and printing on top. Now, what's the problem with putting pictures on top of that? Well, basically, all of these programs, no matter whether you use like the free version for like which you can download like as an open source software, or you use like the €10,000 a year commercial version of it, none of them have any reasonable options for importing bitmap graphics or vector graphics or any graphics at all. It's pretty amazing. Like, you can kind of make do with some of them, but all of the time it's a pretty convoluted process and it takes like several, I don't know, worst case, like half an hour or something to do something like, for example, this graphic logo, which you might not see, which is like a TrueType font in a box, you know? So what you can generally achieve with that is, is like graphics like this. So you have like a pixel graphic, and for every pixel you have like a little box. Like literally you have a single box in your Gerber file for every pixel of the graphic. So I thought, yeah, I kind of want to do better, especially since I am using like primarily two different tools, like an open source one and a commercial one, and both of them require like totally different workflows for like getting graphics into them. So what I did is I built a little Python script, which turned out to be quite a mess in the end, of like 200 something lines of code, which you basically take a, the workflow is basically go into GIMP, import a picture of your board, zoom out, yeah. Then you position like the graphic you want to have onto it. Then you go on, go ahead and take that graphic and apply some sort of thresholding to it. For example, GIMP's posterize effect is awesome for that. And then you run this script with the original Gerber files, which don't include the graphics, and which kind of, for example, look like this. And with the bitmap graphic you export from GIMP, and you get something like this in the end. This is a different example. And this now, instead of the original bitmap graphics, you have like embedded into the SIL screen, so the white layer of that Gerber file, you have like polygons in Gerber. So if I click on this, this is actually like a polygon and in the Gerber file. So like, I converted that with this pixel graphic with like OpenCV into this polygon format, which is then embedded into the Gerber file. And this is actually a format which you can then send to a Chinese PCB manufacturer, and they will be able to produce that PCB. So after you've seen that, which is like kind of the state of the art right now, which primarily has the limitation that it doesn't scale. Like if you try to do that kind of graphic on a whole board of like 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters, like these tools just don't do it. Like they did with the one really expensive commercial tool, I waited like an entire day, 24 hours for the tool to finish rendering. And it still wasn't done. Yeah, so that's kind of unworkable. But now, thanks to the script I created, you can do stuff like this with perfect ease. The resulting file is like 5 megabytes or something. It's not really compact, but it's doable. Like, for example, most of these Chinese manufacturers accept like 10 megabytes, like whatever fits in an email attachment, you can send them and they will be able to produce it. Another example is this one, which I rather like because this is like the posterized effect of GIMP piped through like this OpenCV contraption piped into a Gerber file. And if you send that to a Chinese manufacturer, like the dot size of that posterized effect is actually the size of dots they can actually just manufacture with their silk screen process. So yeah, this tool, I hope, like at some point I will probably even write documentation for it, I hope might be useful for people who like also want to put like pretty pictures on their PCBs without waiting like for days to finish for their tools to finish rendering. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm so much prepared to say somebody that he will reach his 10 minutes, but nobody does. So. Okay. Back to this laptop. And next up, we will hear something about plant protein profile databases. So. Do you have slides? Do you know?
Yeah, I sent them like 2 minutes after 8.
Okay, so perhaps they are there?
Maybe. Oh yeah, they are.
Ha! Worked.
Yeah.
Okay, which ones?
That one? Datengarten.
Ah.
I probably should have written my name. Yours.
Take that.
Thanks.
Erstmal Sunfades wechseln.
Mach mal dieses. Guck mal, wenn das klein ist. Das sieht gut aus. English, German? Probably English, right?
So,
Hi. Are you recording this? Do I need to speak in that? Okay. Okay. So I'll be talking to you about, as it says, plant protein profile database, machine learning, and saving the climate. For full disclosure, with this idea, I'm starting up with a friend of mine, so don't be surprised. Climate change. Ever heard of that? I assume you have. This is a big problem, as you all know, and when I sat down with my friend Arndt, we kind of asked ourselves, okay, what is the most we can do to make this problem go away to the best of our abilities? Keep in mind, we're molecular biologists, so the answer might surprise you. The biggest problem with climate change is animal farming. So the Simpsons were right, cows are actually out to kill you. But fret not, biologists are here to save the day again by providing alternatives to animal products that are way better for the environment. There's kind of a trend in the US. There was a talk actually at the last Chaos Communication Congress about that, about technologies and companies that try to mitigate climate change by providing good alternatives to animal products. For example, the most known one would probably be Just, better known as Hampton Creek. What they do is a plant-based egg replacement, and they build up a food brand and managed to put that in their product Just Mayo in all Warmington, the US. So this sounds like I'm making an advertisement, but why is that important? Because plant-based is not for vegans anymore. It's about replacing everything that's animal-based by plant-based products so that we can reduce the output of animal agriculture as quickly as possible. And the biggest the biggest points we can attack is animal agriculture, because most of the gases that come out of there are something like methane from cow production. And the good thing about, well, the bad thing about methane is that it's something like 25 to 40 times more potent than CO2 in the atmosphere. The good thing is that it's the half-time is way lower, so we could actually, if we reduce that, we could actually make it. So we haven't lost this battle yet. What they do, the science behind this, they have a huge database with plant extracts. So what they're trying to do is actually accumulate all sorts of plants and see what they can use them for, because what you might not know is that humanity has grown something like 7,000 different plants for eating. About 150 are still relevant today, and only 10 make out 95% of all food we eat. So when you look at something like, I don't know, meat replacement or some tofu steak, something, and you say, boy, this is crap, why can't they make it better? It's because they're not looking hard enough. Impossible Foods is actually looking hard enough, and they're doing meat replacement, and it's so good. I actually heard vegans tell me that they spit it out disgusted because they actually thought they were eating real meat. The trick here is that they found a protein in soy roots. It's not a protein, it's actually a molecule that is, you find a lot of proteins, like hemoglobin, for example, would be the protein that has this heme, which is the red color in blood. Huh? This one. And they found it in soy root nodules, and they put it in the burger, so the plant-based burger bleeds, and that's important, so it gets brown and for these all reactions when you fry it. So this is the replacement that you can do, and so where you can get plant-based meat that is almost unrecognizable from animal-based meat. And there are also guys going with classical molecular biology, where you take a bacteria, you put in some DNA, and you let it express proteins in a big vat and just extract them. And they're doing gelatin, because gelatin is not only for gummy bears, it's important for research, for medicine, for cosmetics, so it has a wide application. And they already managed to produce that, even though gelatin is mostly made of carcasses and pig skin and stuff that supposedly is stuff you throw away, you can still produce it more sustainable, especially more sustainable and cheaper. So I guess I'm representing the part of the environmental movement who's tired of going on the streets and shouting at people who won't listen anyway, and trying to produce real alternatives. So RDA is a bit combining a bit of all of that. So the idea would be to actually build a database, but a database with actually where you don't take plant extracts, but you actually go into the plants and you look what's inside there. So, yeah, I whipped it up in 10 minutes, so it might be a bit cryptic and in German, as I see. So we're basing that on next-generation sequencing. So it's basically DNA sequencing has gotten cheaper quicker than computers ever got cheaper quick. So I think Moore's Law, something like the calculating power doubles every 1.5 years or something. The rate of sequencing is 5 times that. So this is why now, while everybody probably remembers the unlocking of the human genome, the Southern Genomes Project, now with something like a human genome can be sequenced for something like €1,000 if you buy it. And if you use it like that, we can probably sequence a plant, or at least the bits that interest us, for also something like €1,000, which makes it feasible to actually build a huge database, which will then we will be able to use to look at, okay, this is from animals, we take this, we look at animal sources that are similar. And the way we do it is building this database with mass spectrometry and next generation sequencing, because you can find out every protein an organism can produce from the DNA, but you can find out if they're actually really producing it and how much and where. So basically this is how you combine it in the database. First of all, next generation sequencing, because it's quicker, standardized, and cheaper, where you find out all theoretically possible proteins, and then you use mass spectrometry to have a look if you can actually find it once you found something that's interesting. So how do I know which proteins to look for? This is where So far, this is all basically wet lab research. So it's people in coats in labs using things that spin and heat, and well, mostly it's that. What we do is we take a target, and to us, the first logical target would be casein, which is the protein that you find in cheese. It's basically the reason why vegan cheese sucks, because they haven't found a replacement yet. And everything cheese, no matter if it's the chemical stuff or the industrial stuff, or actually the one that comes from a farm up in the Alps, casein is the reason why it behaves like cheese, why it melts like that. So if you could find a replacement, you could knock out that problem just by finding it, basically. But in theory, it applies to all sorts of things. So you take that, and this is where it gets probably interesting. You take this DNA, you put it in yeast, and then you just produce it. You extract the protein, and you make cheese out of it. So far, so straightforward. Then you have a GMO cheese, but no one likes GMO. So we go a step further. We look at the properties of the cheese. And then we feed the information, this is at least the idea so far, because as I said before, we're both molecular biologists and have limited knowledge of machine learning, but we think this is how it should work. You feed it into an algorithm, and this is the data you use to teach an algorithm what makes a protein cheesy. And then from that information, you look at the algorithm and you ask the algorithm, okay, if I have this casein sequence, and sequence I'm talking amino acid sequence, I know I'm jumping over a lot of biology stuff that I probably should introduce, which I would do if I had an half an hour, but for 10 minutes this will have to do. You take the sequence, and then you ask the algorithm, okay, what is the least amount of changes I can make for the biggest amount of changes in cheesiness, and the other way around? What is the biggest change to the sequence I can do for the least amount of cheesiness? And you take those sequences, which are variants of casein then, you put it again in yeast, you extract the protein, you build the analog cheese, you test it, and you feed this in the algorithm again, and you do this a couple of times. And hopefully at some point the algorithm is good enough that you can go through your database with it and find candidate proteins, which you then validate, and this is how you make the cheese. So basically this is applicable to every protein-based target you have, and this is what we are trying to do. That's it. Ah, okay. This is what we're trying to do to replace casein and produce a plant-based cheese. And the interesting thing is that you would be able to produce the ingredient that would allow you to knock out every cheese. I'm not talking about one specific cheese, I'm talking about every cheese. And this is the power of what biology can do for you in those types of problems, because I don't know if you ever tried to convince someone to eat something different because it's bad for him, bad for everyone, too expensive, whatever. It's very hard, next to impossible, but you can do something about it without having the behavioral change. Okay, this is a bit more of that. Oh, I actually had pictures for that. So this is the part where you do the yeast. This is the part where you mutate it. This is how you build the database. And this is how you get to your protein. This is how you make analog cheese, by the way. So this is why it would work. Because you can basically make cheese by taking casein, adding fat, wicking salt and water, whip it up in a tank. And you actually can do it at home already. It's, very roughly only look like cheese, but this is how easy it actually is to make cheese if you have the right ingredients. The hard part is, as I said, getting the right ingredients. Okay, that's it. Thanks.
That was really, on the second, very good timing. It was exactly 10 minutes. So... let's see who's next. Next is Robin. And he will talk about the mechanical poetry of word embeddings. So, here's your slides. Again, I have to move them here. And now I know to press that one. Here you go. Cool.
Thank you, Karina. Frohe Weihnachten, data gardeners.
I'm Robin. I'm going to try and convince you that there is something called a word embedding, which will let you do maths with words. Forgive me reading from a script, but I tend to ramble, so I thought I would keep it in 10 minutes. So, what is a word embedding? It's effectively a numerical representation of a word that describes the context in which a word is usually found. So, it's a vector in an arbitrary dimensional space. So, just a quick explanation of what that is for those that aren't full like programmer nerds. The words are in the column on the left here. The vector representation of the numbers going across to the side. So basically you take a word and then represent it as this sequence of numbers. And that sequence can be as long as you like. The longer it is, the more accurate your results will be. There's a certain diminishing returns after about 300 digits. It's not really worth expanding any further. But why then would you choose to do that? The main use of the case for this is in natural language processing. So algorithms that take in human language or spit out human language or do both. But why then would these series of numbers that are completely inscrutable to the eye be more useful than the words that we can all understand in the first column? And the main reason is that we can do maths on them. So here's some maths. This is what's called a cosine similarity analysis. The detail's not important for the purposes of a 10-minute talk, but the idea is that you're able to tell how far apart certain words are numerically. So you can get an idea not just of that something, some word has a synonym or an antonym, hoping that translates reasonably well to non-English native speakers, but for basically a measure of similarity or differentness of words. And it's not just Boolean, so not just yes, they're similar, no, they're not, but you get this measurement of how close they are. This picture, by the way, the credit goes to Christian S. Perrone, 2013, on the Terra Incognita blog, No, there's one later that I've forgotten to credit, but that doesn't matter. I can explain it if anyone needs to know where they've come from later. So, you get this idea of the commonality of the context of the word. So just briefly then, these two at the front here roughly have a similar vector. They're sort of close synonyms. The ones in the middle have like a cosine of zero. They're completely unrelated. And the two on the far side are kind of opposites. They're antonyms, really. So other maths that you could do is vector arithmetic or sort of vector algebra. And this starts to give you a compound idea. So this is sort of like nonsense maths, except for the fact that it is actual maths on these numbers. And this is a genuine result from these word vectors. So what we've got here, just to sort of to speak through what you're looking at, you take the idea of Paris. And then you subtract the idea of France. So this, remember, is the vectors behind these words, not the words themselves. And what that leaves you with is this notion of a capital, which you can then apply to Germany. And then going back to this previous technique here, it doesn't literally come out with a vector for Berlin, but it comes out with a vector that is very, very close to the one for Berlin. Indeed, the closest one in this case is the one for Berlin. Incidentally, you can put in Berlin minus poor. No, hang on, let me get this the right way around. Berlin minus sexy. No, hang on, that's not right either. Berlin minus sexy plus rich, and it comes out with Munich. So, yeah, so you can get with these with this algebra, you can get to a sort of a compound idea. In fact, I'll go on to that in a sec, but you can start to see syntactic patterns. So what we've got here is a series of very similar difference vectors between words separating male and female genders. So there's another result which is like king minus man plus woman equals queen and that sort of thing. And then here a slightly different one looking at comparatives and superlatives. I'm not going to read the slide out, you can see what it says. So you get to these compound ideas, of course, so then you can then get to vectors for sentences, and you can see how being able to do maths on words is suddenly quite a powerful idea. You can distinguish a certain definition of a term from other definitions. I think I'm stealing a slide from later, but if you take the idea of a cat and then you subtract the idea of a dog, you're left with the idea of CAT scanning, so tomography, CT scanning. So you can see how this starts to be a useful representation. So I'll bring up a slide and then not talk about it. I'll talk about something else briefly, but I've not got a slide for this. But in case you're wondering how these are created, I'm not going to tell you that either. I don't want to go into too much detail, but suffice to say there are a few algorithmic approaches to doing this. And the basic intuition is that it tries to capture a representation of each word in terms of the context of other words that it co-occurs with. So you can basically, just for a little more detail, if you're curious, take the product of these, and that gives you the percentage co-occurrence rate. So if you are interested in using this sort of thing, there's stuff like Google's Word2Vec and the Global Vectors Project that provides already pre-trained vectors for these. You don't need to necessarily go away and do all the machine learning stuff yourself. You can basically take any sort of tokenized words, so basically any words in text form, and then look up these vectors and you've got them to play with. And of course there's libraries in like every language under the sun for loading these representations up and doing the sorts of similarity, nearness and algebra type things I've mentioned before. So those that sort of drifted off during the science bit then may be wondering what the practical application of all this is. This diagram describes an idea called Swanson linking, which I believe Swanson came up with before it was, you know, as an idea, before it was actually ever proven. But then later results showed that it was possible, that you can kind of take knowledge from two different domains and then apply results from one onto the other and discover new things. So it's nothing, this math that you're doing on these words doesn't give you new results, it just shows you results that were already there but you'd never seen before. So what else can you do? Simply to identify synonyms, which is kind of already what I'd shown, but you can then go on to generate thesauruses from these rather than having to have a team that sort of sits and writes them all. You can expand queries and specify them more, exactly like I was saying about CAT scanning. You can retrieve information, not just by looking at a query, but you can basically throw in a document and say, you know, tell me other things like this. You don't need to sort of figure out your finely tuned terms to throw into your search engine. You can just throw it at your current state of your essay or whatever it is that you're writing your report. Machine translation. I won't get stuck into it. Basically, you can generate new novel translations. This process, they discovered new translations from English into Chinese that none of the source data that went into it included. It's also helped with entity recognition. Here's a few results that I found, rather cheesily called mechanical poetry, because it is a bit awkward sometimes, but then, you know, it's words, so it has that kind of poetic meaning. So yeah, in summary, word embeddings let you do maths on words. If you want any more information, you can Google mechanical poetry, and if you put in infonomics, which is like my domain, that will get you to the blog post where it goes through in more detail. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Next up is Danimo, or Daniel, or however you want to be introduced. Also, it's your laptop, you can use it better than I can. Okay. Here you go.
And now it's F11. This time it's F11. Okay, so I want to use my 10 minutes to answer a simple question that has been asked quite a lot of times, but I have rarely time to really explain. And that is because usually whenever people approach me, when we do recordings as the video operations center, we're rather busy running around doing recordy stuff. And so the answer is to the question, how exactly do you do the things you do, and why are releases generally available so quickly? So I want to give a brief summary about what we do and how we do it, and I want to give a bit of an overview of like the tools we are using and show you that you can actually produce the same results yourself. Typically, if you record a conference without a setup, you buy expensive hardware, you record stuff. You do post-pro with even more expensive software. And really, you're at the conference, and then time goes by, and then you need to invest the same amount of hours that you spent recording in post-pro. And really, no. And then the disk dies that the recordings are on, and you know, it's usually, sometimes it's just never gonna happen. So this is really the takeaway that the people that started all this had. It's like, what's not happening on the conference is not gonna happen, especially if you're a volunteer task force, right? You can throw money at the problem, whatever you want, and sometimes the people doing it will get it right, but yeah, especially if you're in volunteers, it's just not gonna happen. So, what's our stack? People always ask, what's your stack? What's your stack? It's okay, let's try this. So, this is what it actually looks like. What you're not seeing here is a disk that we built to be very, very silent. That's doing the actual recording using SDI from this camera, sometimes even a second camera. And something that grabs slides from HDMI from the front. And we also started running our own or bringing our own audio setup. And that is because sometimes, you know, inexpensive locations have inexpensive, you know, PA. And sound that is okay for a PA, if you listen to that on the video, it's incredibly noisy. So usually what we try is, in case we're not sure, we bring our own audio setup and attach that to the PA rather than trusting the PA. So PA being public address, like the speakers that you have in the room. And the core asset really that we have is VoctoMix. So previously we used the tool from the Debian guys. That was back in times when we recorded an SD, and eventually we wanted to go to high definition. And the problem there was that the DV format that we were using wasn't really up to the task. And so we rebuilt something using GStreamer and Python, and that eventually became VoctoMix. It's deployed, it's sort of a server client model. So what you're seeing here, the UI, is really just a client that allows to steer the core that does the actual recording, which makes it way more robust, if you will. And so why are we doing this in software rather than buying expensive hardware? And the answer is really here. Hardware eventually fails, software eventually works. The flexibility that this gives us is really priceless. And we really want to make sure everyone can build this on their own, which is hardly possible if you just say, okay, buy this hardware. What hardware? Well, the hardware that we bought last year, yeah, that's not available anymore, and you've got to figure out how to do the new revision on yourself. Rather than using commodity hardware, which is what we recommend, and it's really easy to adapt. Usually it boils down to modifying a couple of lines in Ansible, and we're doing that ourselves regularly. So everything we do in software is either available on GitHub, I'll show you later, or /or is available as Ansible recipes, again on GitHub. So that should be good. We've got servers that we can deploy on location for bigger shows, for bigger events. We've got even more servers in a data center that is going to, or that's helping us transcoding, encoding the final videos, transcoding the streams, and finally serving up media CC CDE in several locations. Also, we of course need stats to actually make sure that somebody's actually watching and that everything is working fine. We're trying to ensure a certain amount of quality. For instance, this is something we started at the last Chaos Communication Congress. This is the target loudness of the streams that we want to achieve, and you can see here that the translation of room 6 was not correct, so you can easily correct that. And so this is, if you switch between streams, then you have to modify volume, and that was also always a bit nasty, and we tried to fix that. So this is the, you know, means of QA that we try to apply. Another piece of software that we're using is Vocto Web, which is basically what you see on Media CC CDE, and it's basically around YouTube. And the other core asset when it comes to releasing stuff is the ticket tracker. So we can verbatimly import a schedule that's produced by the leading open source event planning software. The schedule.xml is basically the format that almost everyone seems to be using these days. And we can import that, and then we basically have a workflow from recording, from doing the master rendering, and then all the dependent formats, WebM for everyone who doesn't want MPEG, and then the low quality versions, and then audio only, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and this really does all the things. It takes us through the workflow, it makes us check that the master rendering is actually okay. If that's okay, it uploads it to Media CC CDE, makes us, renders all the, or tells workers to actually then do their dependent formats and also uploads them. So this is pretty used. This is like the tool that takes away most of our work, because it just ensures everyone just follows the workflow, machine and human. We're going to talk about this later. So, and the other thing we do is we try to constantly improve. Like, this is one of the prototypes that we had for showing camera people that they're live, so-called telelight. And this is just a Raspberry Pi with an LED. Of course, that would be overkill. And the reason is we eventually want to turn this into an intercom as well. That's why it's called telecom. So this is the prototype. And this is the pretty result in the end with, you know, a good, nice case around it and a camera mount. So, and to wrap it up, because we're really late in my 5 minutes, everything's open source. If you want to go there, it's GitHub/walk, or just take the code. And if you're looking for things to do, go there. That's part of our wiki, c3walk/wiki. And there's a lot of stuff to do if you want to join. And if you actually want to look into this for using it in your company or for your small, for your, let's say, theater group or whatever, come see me. Like recently, a major CDN provider actually notified us on Twitter that they were also using VoctoMix to do their internal recordings. So that was pretty nice to see. And I think with that, we'll wrap it up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So the guy who's running his work is making it harder for me. Das war's nicht. Okay, wie komme ich da jetzt wieder raus? Ach so, F11 war jetzt mein Freund. Ja, mit Escape komme ich zur Start-Slide, das hilft uns nichts. Okay, very well matching. We now hear about CCCTV. Where it's about the videos which get produced. And afterwards, we have a short break, but the last 10 minutes before yours.
Yeah, we'll probably not need 10 minutes. So, hi, I'm Stefan. Thanks to Danimo, you already know how the videos are hosted and how they went online. I want to tell you a little story about an app I built. It starts with visiting, probably. Ah, that's good. I don't have to type everything. Probably you all know this site, mediaccc.de. And I'm usually between Christmas and New Year's Eve. When I'm not at the conference, I'm a really lazy person and I sit on my couch with a remote, with a D-pad, so up, down, left, right, and back. And that's it. And I want to stream this stuff for mediaccc.de. So you can go to info and then you see all the apps that support mediaccc.de. And up until, I guess, summer, there was no Android TV apps. There was the only possibility to see mediaccc content on your TV was Apple TV, which is a proprietary closed box. And it doesn't even stream everything because Apple is not fine with everything on mediaccc, especially the Mac hacking stuff. Anyways, I built an Android TV app. And actually, I wanted to show you a showcase of it, but my laptop didn't work here, so I guess I'll have to do with this. So you can check it out on GitHub. By today, it's online again, and I guess I will just show you some screenshots. So is there like a can't I do those bigger? With this button, right? No. Anyways, it's pretty straightforward. You have, I compared it to the Apple TV app where you see all 120 conferences just in a list. I try to group them so you see Congress, conference events, broadcast and blinking lights, and then in those categories you have like on Congress when you press to the right you have all the congresses ordered from the latest to the oldest, and then you can just see all the videos there. And if you decide to open one, it starts playing on the very top, and on the bottom you see the information, and you can. It's a pretty easy app actually, but yeah. Sadly, I cannot show you so much live stuff. What did I want to mention else? Has anyone used it up until now? Or does anybody have an Android TV, a Fire TV stick? Ah, okay. You can get the APK from GitHub. The releases are on GitHub. And install it on your Fire TV. I will upload it at some point. Yeah. But if you upload apps to Fire TV, you really have to hate yourself. So, Amazon. I'm not going into that. So what I wanted to mention, I guess I still have some time. I'm really grateful for the people helping me to get this app online again, because I built the app and I just uploaded the first version. Everything was fine. I had 10 users or so, and 3 days later I just updated some texts and uploaded a version where you can search in the app, and then my complete account got frozen, and they said I'm violating impersonation policy because I'm not the CCC, which they are right, but with Creative Commons stuff. Anyways, I talked to the some people and I got a little sheet of paper Google Play was happy with, and now you can celebrate with me because today the app is finally live again and you can all have a look at it. I have a roadmap. There's still plenty of stuff to do. If somebody knows Android, you can help me out. I'm really trying hard to get the streaming in the app until Christmas. But you can watch all the content which is already live, like it is now. So maybe questions, or I guess there's time for questions after the stream.
So thank you very much. I will definitely try it out. Currently, I'm using like Kodi or Plex, and a plugin in there on my Android thingy, and it's kind of annoying. So I'm really happy if there's a direct access to get that, and I'll try that out on all our Fire TV and Fire TV sticks, which we have at home, which is kind of a bunch. Don't ask me why we have so many. Yes, now it's time for a break, and since nearly all of the speakers are still there, you have the chance to talk to them and ask a question. Perhaps for a very short minute, everybody, or just some seconds, can stand up who had a talk so that people remember which names there were. So we had, let's go back. Yeah, I think Zip already had to go, but... But Lasse can answer stuff. Yeah, wave your hand for short. Then we had the stuff about high quality bitmaps on your tiny things from Jacek, who's still somewhere here, exactly. He will come upstairs because he wants, he's in the kitchen. He's in the kitchen. He's hungry and wants to prepare food. He's waiting for us to have a break. And then there's Karim talking about the protein databases. Yeah, he's over there. Robin about mechanical poetry. And Danimo, which is back there at the camera for this VOC. As you can see easily. And yeah, last but not least, we just heard from Stefan. Yeah, it's even bold, so I'm just too close to it, about the CCTV. And so now we make a break, I would say for about 20 minutes, so everybody can get a drink, go to the toilet, have a smoke, whatever. And on the stream, we'll be back then with the second set of talks. Thanks. Okay. Also to the people, welcome back on the streams. Everyone in the stream perhaps waited totally, when will it go on? They said 20 minutes and this was more like 30 minutes. But yeah, that's how it is. But now we come to our second part of our lightning talks. We have some left, as you can see. And the next one, which is coming up now, is about free software and the four freedoms in terms of JavaScript and the web, from Paul, who's hiding here next to me. And so, I give it to you. And enjoy, everybody.
All right. This is more going to be some kind of an essay. I'm Paul Hensch. I am what they call... the webmaster of the Free Software Foundation Europe. And however, this talk is, I'm not here on behalf of any of my employers, and these thoughts are entirely my own. I want to make this clear. And I'd like to start with a thought experiment. What is if I were to write a software as an only author, let's say a desktop program, something useful, something funny. And I'd say I put this program under, let's say, GPL version 3, a typical free software license, and I distribute this in binary form on my website and say, you can download this, you don't give me anything in return, you can just use it for whatever you want. But each time you ask me to give you the source code, I just fail to respond to your email. It's going to be pretty hard to sue me about this or something, because you haven't given me anything in return. I can just withhold it. I just don't give it to you. So it's not really something... I don't think you can do a lot about this. So this program is obviously not free software. I told you it is. So... But it's not the license which makes a program free software. It is the four freedoms we try to point out all the time. It's the freedom to use a software. You've got this in the example. And it is the freedom to study the source code of a software. And in my example, my program falls short of this freedom. There's also the freedom to modify a software. And to to hand out copies of your of this modified version of your software, of helping your neighbor. And those two more freedoms are equally important, because we have normally assumptions about what free software does for us. We like to tell people that it's more secure because of some many eyes principle, because people can look at the source code. We tend to assume that it doesn't spy on us and doesn't contain any backdoors, and that free software in general acts on our behalf, on the behalf of the user of it. But then again, we have free software like the Ubuntu operating system, which in its default configuration contains spyware. We have Chrome, the Chrome web browser, which is free software, but yet spies on you as a user. And even Firefox is taking some liberties with my liberties, I feel. So these assumptions we have about free software only work if we really got those two more, this third and fourth freedom. We make those assumptions because other people can modify a software, not only review it, and because we can all we can really receive software from another distributor, which, for example, provides us with an IceWeasel or Firefox Klar version of Firefox, or with a Chromium, or with a Lubuntu fork, or whatever. Now, I'd like to talk about a topic which is which I feel is rarely talked about in the free software community, and which I perceive as a problem. I'd like to have a discussion about free software on web services, and in particular about JavaScript, which a website pushes into my browser, and which I am, as a visitor of a website, am expected to just execute on my computer. There's many websites which just provide a document to me, just some text to read, and not even do something, but which still expect me to execute code just to be able to read this website. I think I have a hard time even reviewing this code, because a website can change at any time. But in theory, I can review it. I can study this JavaScript because it's always like plain in front of me. But independently from the license it is under, I have a hard time of modifying it in the context of the website I want to view. I can download it and make a modified version and put it on my own web server, use it on my own website as a producer. But from a user's point of view, I think I already fall short of this third freedom. And what I definitely can't do is, I can't, if this JavaScript tracks you or downloads malware from anywhere else on the internet, I cannot improve the situation for anyone else. I cannot make this web service use a different version of a modified version of this JavaScript software. So you as visitors, even though I might have improved this situation for myself, I cannot help anyone else doing the same. So I believe that we as developers, as web developers, should try to avoid forcing users to enable a JavaScript engine just to view a website. I acknowledge that this is a beautiful programming language and you can have a lot of fun with it, but I think we expose users to people who try to take away their freedoms via web services and via services they could in theory copy, but which they cannot control if they use it only on this website. I think there's a lot of alternatives. I know that you can build dynamic and responsive websites by just learning really good CSS, and you should all do this. I wanted to start this discussion, and I wanted to bring this issue to your attention, not only not only as a as an issue for vision impaired people or for making websites available to everyone, but also as a free software issue. Thank you for your attention.
So, thank you very much. Great. I waited for this to happen. Somebody in our pad, yeah, thanks for getting it back. I really expected somebody to annoy me a bit with our pad, because it's of course open for everybody to use and to do stuff. The next one up is Vicky Naut. He will give a short Mixed Pickles talk about open source software Börse, so the Stack Exchange, and the Patent Office. So yeah, come over.
And, thank you very much. Okay, first I want to introduce myself. I started participating and contributing to open source software in about 2004. No, it was in 1995 when I migrated Agrep, approximate Grep, from C to OS2. At those times. Agrep, you should have an eye on it. It's an approximate fuzzy pattern grep, which is can also be used for DNA sequences and searches, and it's quite useful. It's fully open source now, because I contacted the University of Arizona and tried two decades to get this free. So this was my. This is one of my main impacts to the open source community. The second one is I wrote in 2004 the whole email notification for MediaWiki, which is used in Wikipedia. And in those times, let's see, from the mid of the 90s until now, I had always two ideas. One was, when Jeff Bezos from Amazon came with these incredible, let's say stupid and easy one-click patent, I thought, why the hell did nobody else before came up with this idea of a single-click patent? I guess you know all of these problems. And the problem is that no students, housewives and scholars and children who have ideas could not publish at those time their ideas, even if they are stupid. But with the Wiki idea, coming from Ward Cunningham, I think it was 2001 when Wiki technology was invented, I think it's quite easy for everyone to publish the ideas. What is in line 27, open source software patent patent office, it is very close to the idea that everyone should be able and should be willing to publish even tiny ideas very early. I must confess, now we have GitHub and these other open source repositories. I just want to bring you up to this point of my view. It should be easy, it should be reliable, there should be a history of all commits and changes to the ideas, and also contributions. So the people who had the ideas, they should get their acknowledgments and probably copyrights. It should be free, it could be controlled, it could be hosted by the CCC, for example, as a platform. And I just want also to mention that there was a similar idea of the bounty quest. Is anyone here who knows of the now stopped website Bounty Quest? Okay, this was initiated by Jeff Bezos from Amazon. He wanted to know who had the idea of one-click patent before, and he put a bounty of $10,000 for the whole world, or for everyone who came up with a prior art for one-click patent. And this was then extended, and every company or private person could place a bounty, could write the idea onto a website, and if someone would contribute prior art, the bounty would have been paid to these persons. The New York School of Law has launched a project which was called Peer to Patent, where big companies like IBM could place their patent applications before they were published. So they were published on these servers to the public. And the advantage was that they get a fast track and patent patent examination, because the hope was that the public contributed more prior art, which compared to what the patent office could find to the, in the same amount of time. And another mixed pickle is that since 1995, public and still present service, which is called PGP Digit Timestamping Service, exists. It still exists at, since 1995. And my idea was that persons who publish something could send the hash of their publication, even not the publication, but simply the hash, to that timestamping service, which still has a log of all submitted mails, which returned then signed with a UTC timestamp. And this was like an early anticipation of the what we call now blockchain. So this, these ideas together could form something like a software patent office. And you may ask why I have this line 26 open source software Börse. With that I mean, if you have tiny ideas, you want to have a project, a software project, you can even place a bounty, so a premier, and to ask everyone, students, everyone, to participate and to develop software for you. I, for myself, placed a bounty of a quarter of a Bitcoin some years ago for a development of a further development of Paperback. Paperback is a software basically on Windows, where you can print any binary data, so onto one or many sheets of paper in form of dots, and the density is much higher than QR codes. And one QR code can only code about, I think, 3,000 bytes or no bits, bytes, and the Paperback software can code more on a sheet of paper. And so many ideas. Okay, and the bounty was now placed to have an open source port of this Windows software using Assembler to a fully Linux version. And I'm pretty sure that many of you here and also on the web have ideas like that. And I can only encourage you, please post bounties, please post your ideas, make them public to avoid patenting on such ideas, even if they may be stupid. Thank you.
So, thank you very much. Perhaps somebody saw we have quite like in time change, because we have the last two talks which are not streamed, but we have one had in between which should be streamed, so this is kind of complicated to do, so we just switch them. So, but now, next up is Credibility Investigate, News Source Credibility. It's you, perfect, because I don't have a name here. So, you have to introduce yourself very shortly. And then the next 10 minutes are yours. So, here you are.
Hi. Hi, ma'am. I'm Alvin from Malaysia. I'm just visiting in Berlin. And I didn't know about CCC before. I didn't know about the Congress before. But my friend introduced me, and so I met Sabah yesterday to collect the ticket as well. And he told me about this event, which is great. Thanks, thanks, Sabah. So maybe I want to.
Yeah.
Sorry about the delay. So my slide is here, so I have to yeah, so I didn't really prepare much, because I just decided to come, and when I look at the talks put on the share pad there, I feel like I want to talk about this again. Oh, sorry. Yeah. This one. Yeah. Okay. So this is about my project I've done long time ago, like in 2013, when F5. Yeah. Does it work? Okay, yeah, it's a PDF. So it's about a project which I was inspired from not really inspired. I was angry as well, because there's this incident of Aaron Swartz, who committed suicide last time, and I didn't know about Aaron Swartz, and I checked about the news, and I checked about everywhere. I try to understand this guy. This was like really a big news in on the internet, and I want to find out like what's going on. So these some of the result I get from like trying to find out the news, and I found out like there are like news from different sites and news from different talking about different things. So I just try to start this project. It's trying to investigate credibility of the news source on controversial topics. So, okay, these slides was prepared in a bar camp in Bangkok. So, actually, I should skip some of the slides here, which is not no longer important. So I think now we still have this problem. We're sick of reading biased news, and we're sick of reading like fake news, and actually like to recognize whether a news is actually fake or not is really a hard problem. Even ourselves, we cannot actually recognize it. We cannot actually differentiate it. So this first website I've done is just based on a very simple concept. It's like read stories from the both sides. So maybe I just go to. Oops. Yeah. It's easier to just show you the the website. So the website layout is pretty simple. It's just like there's one side of a story saying like, oh, prosecutor has bullied, and the other side is about like, oh, some news source talking about, oh, this Aaron Swartz is like a hacker and this is like not lawful and stuff. So the very first concept I come up with is like, okay, just put everything. Let's put everything on like one page, and we see which one is we should actually. The other thing is, in here I'm not trying to ask somebody to see like one set of news. I want to let like how we investigate like the news as well. Like we always look at many news. And we know, like sometimes this is more truthful, and this is not. I think most of the people they have this process of like reading many news and find out what's really going on. So this is a very simple concept I came out with. Yeah, so I'm not here to talk about like, oh, I have this cool project and I have to tell you guys about it, but it's something like I want to grab the attention again, and let's rethink and review about like how can we can actually solve this problem. So previously I was there and listening to Robin talks about the like language processing and the words embedding thing. Then it is also something like can trigger some ideas and stuff. I was talking about this topic in a bar camp, but when I was there, it's like everyone was just looking at me like this is so hard to solve, and like what are you talking about? And I'm really glad here because I found like CCC like is like a open source community, and like hacktivists and all the cyberpunks, maybe yeah, you guys are here. That's why maybe you can tell me, just throw me like anything, like comments, like criticism or something. Just tell me about it. So now we have news source from everywhere. We have public media, we have social media. I talked with Robin just now, and we say like sometimes we don't know what is going on in the content of the news, then sometimes we just retweet and we know like maybe the 500 followers will just read it, and yeah, and it will become viral. So we have some responsibility as well when we retweet, or yeah, when we tell somebody else about this, because like in here maybe we know we have exposure, and this afternoon I just watched one talk from Sava about the PEP. she will talk about it later again. So she talked about something very important, that is we might know what is going on, but not the other friends who are not maybe not techie and who are not just reading one news source. So it's actually quite important to actually to show people they are like fake news. They are also fake news. They are also like things that you might not discover. It's all about exposure. Like me, when I came, I was in Berlin. I didn't know about CCC. I didn't know about everything. Like, but my friends told me about this, and I got the exposure, and I get to come here. So it's also about like the important things that the facts should go out to become available, not only for like a minority, but to the majority, to the mainstream as well. And it's actually a very still very hard problem to solve, and we talk about it, and yeah. Okay. I think that's all I have, and not really about good content, but just sharing about my passion about this thing. Yep. So like nowadays there are more tools that we can have access to, like the deep learning things and more research just are going on to actually help. Maybe we can find some way to actually solve this problem. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So next up is the already mentioned Sva, who will talk about pretty easy privacy. So let me fire up your talk now that I've learned which button to press. No, this is okay.
So some might have seen that I proposed like a list, and I just saw now when I was deleting it that some people put a plus and minus. So there were quite some pluses at GNUnet, so I'm trying to have this in here as well. So it's 2218. So I'm going through it fast and then maybe spend a bit more time on GNUnet. So this is about pretty easy privacy. Pretty easy privacy comes from pretty good privacy. As written in the pad, it's about rolling out mass encryption. So I have those four chapters. General problem is known in this group, I believe, and what we're trying to do is mass encryption and mass anonymization. So rewrite software, like we're coming from this cypherpunk idea, where we have an engine, which is basically like an API. I come to this later. And then we have adapters in various languages, which are kind of bindings to plug in the engine into applications. So here's another example. Does this also have a pointer? Ha, great. So plugin or app adapter and engine. So here's an example on Outlook, which is already in production, which uses this COM server adapter to plug in the engine. Here is for Android apps, you have an GNI adapter. For iOS apps, you have an Objective-C adapter and various more. Here's a list of the repos. Here's the URLs. Go to pep.foundation/software. That's the easiest. There you can get all this. So you see there's quite some more adapters, like a Python adapter, a Qt adapter. So the idea is that like we are also creating apps, but ideally that existing apps which are there, which are on the side of interpersonal communication, just plug in the engine to actually get encryption done without having to care for the encryption. So we're developing on all platforms, and this engine which you can plug in cares for the messaging functions, cryptotext services, has fully automated key management, knows about the transport protocols. So that's at the moment only email and like IMAP, SMTP exchange and that stuff, but it shall also know about other protocols in the future. As well in the future, this mass anonymization, like the metadata protection. And I come to this later. But the important part is here, a developer can just plug and play without having to care for the crypto. So the engine does all the decryption, encryption, MIME encoding, processes the message to the adapter, which then processes it to the actual application. Key management and also key synchronization. I'm also coming to this later. So general PEP is about making, like giving up on the idea, like we're all coming from this crypto party movement and like teaching people on like various events how to use GPG, and at the end we're just glad if 1% of them actually starts using it. So at one point we were just like, okay, what the fuck, let's stop this. And instead of telling the people what to do, we just write software which does what the people should do. So instead of writing how-to guides, we write user expectations into software and standards. Which doesn't mean that the how-to guides shouldn't be there. They should be still there. Everyone who wants to get engaged shall get all the information. We also started an internet draft together with the ISOC Switzerland. It's online and ready for discussion. This is how it looks like. You all know how it looks like. So that's there. Please have a look and do a comment on it. It's not a RFC yet. It's first an internet draft. Then it goes into an RFC, but still it's a request for comment at this point of time as well. Another part of the concept is that it shall be easy, which is there. So the Outlook thing, which is already productive, means that people write emails. There's no difference. There's nothing they have to do in addition. It's just that the email then is like yellow or green, like depending on the kind of encryption or on the level where you are. But every Outlook user installs the plugin and just continues writing emails. There's no difference, but it'll be encrypted. There's one thing which the user needs to do, which is that fingerprint comparison, which we translate into trust words. Because we do trust on first use, so the key will always be attached to every email. So this is how we solve the key exchange problem without any like central key servers or anything. So we just attach the key to every email, but that means that there might be a person in the middle. So people have to be really secure, they have to compare their fingerprints, but instead of fingerprints, we use those trust words. Then another part to make it easy is the sync, which I already mentioned. So if you have more than one device where you have PEP, it'll be synced with each other. So the devices just create a device group, and then you have a like device keys and a group key. And then we sync everything over IMAP, actually, which is quite a trick. And it took us quite a while to find that out, that this would be the trick to actually get it done. So far, there's no solution out there to actually get your keys synced besides using any kind of Apple Cloud or stuff like that. Which means you can also not only sync your keys, but also your contacts and calendar. You're not using the cloud anymore, which is just other people's computers, but you're using your own computers for that. This is how it looked in testing. We're trying to do everything right, so it's peer-to-peer, end-to-end. There is no centralized infrastructure, no closed services whatsoever. PEP is free software, has regular independent code audits, or at least we're trying to. So far there's one, but we just started. We try to be compatible with everything. I already mentioned this is the crypto we do. At the moment, the bolded stuff. And the rest will be coming after a while. It'll be just then in the engine. So if a developer now has whatever, an SMS app on Android and plugs in the engine of PEP, that means right now it just does GPG. But then if the engine then in the future learns about Omemo, it can also do then Omemo encryption, which would be much better for something like SMS. This is what I mentioned, the transport protocols. So at the moment, all the email stuff, and then more stuff coming in the future. But then we know anonymity. I don't think this is news in here, that content encryption is not everything. So we need to have anonymity, and now we come to the GNUNet part. To explain GNUNet, I'm using the analogy of an Internet 2.0. So there's the Internet 1 from the 70s, from the 80s, where we're all like, oh my God, like, great, we can access other computers. Nowadays, we're like, oh yeah, sure we can, but okay, they're also connected to me. This is not really good. So we need to have an internet that is encrypted and anonymized. So their tagline is, you broke the internet, let's make a GNU one. It's a mesh routing layer for end-to-end encrypted networking and a framework for distributed applications designed to replace the old insecure internet protocol stack. So Yeah, here it's pretty old. It started in 2002, but it's also a pretty big thing. I mean, rewriting the internet protocols is nothing you just do like in your cellar once at the weekend, and then you meet up for another weekend and done. So there's a lot of PhDs and like master theses and that stuff. So meanwhile, they're at this point where they are more or less ready. So I have a very hard simplified version of the internet here. And I put a very hard simplified version of the GNUnet next to it. So as a physical layer, we use all the protocols which are already there. Like whatever is there, whatever suits. There's then an algorithm that chooses which protocol to use. After this, on the Ethernet layer, there just comes a plain off-the-record encryption to just obfuscate everything. Like at the moment, we have IP addresses that just leak every information. You can spoof every address and all that, so that'll be gone then. Then on the routing layer, we have a distributed hash algorithm, and then this is the actual network protocol. This is another, that's the GNU name system, and then we have applications. So I think I'm running out of time, but yeah, come and talk to me about this. I find it very important. There is no other slide. Go on GNUnet.org and install it if you're interested. Don't use the release, please. Use the Git, like it's GNUnet.org/git or git.GNUnet.org. Use the version from the Git, but not the release, because that's from 2014, and try it, because now it's really like ready. It won't be totally working, but then you'll be able to find the bugs, and maybe in whatever, 3 years, 5 years, we can tell all our non-geeky friends out there to please install and upgrade the Internet 2.0. So in general, it's that the user doesn't have to think about the crypto anymore and just use it. So we are now, like every day, we're taking a decision, okay, I'm writing this as a GPG email, or I'm going this on Omemo and Jabber, or I'm using Signal or whatever. So this is a decision we cannot take, like let the people out there doing, so we're trying to solve that. We have a company and a foundation. The code belongs to the foundation, so it always remains free. And the company does the applications. Like every one of you has maybe could have an application which you can still sell and whatever. So this is the way how we're trying to stay sustainable. Yeah, that's basically it. This is the current implementations, but I think I'm out of time now. Yes.
Thank you very much. A safer internet. That's really ambitious, and we hope we'll get there. So, now, oh, I forgot to mark stuff now. Now we come to our last talk, because the really last one was cancelled. The person who wanted to give the talk. Huh? No, she told me she can't stay that long. So, unfortunately, she had to leave earlier. And since the next one is without streaming, we will shut off the stream now. So, everybody on the streams, bye, it was nice to see you. Not to see you, but to know you are there. And, yeah, we'll have the next Daten Garden in the next month, directly after Congress, kind of. We already have somebody up in line. Yes. So I'm really happy about that. And now we're leaving you. So give me the sign if it's switched off. Yes. Thanks.